This is Audible.
The Crimson Vault, Book 2 of the Traveler's Gate Trilogy. Written by Will White. Read for you by the author. Chapter 1, A Prison in the Rain. 350th year of the Damascan calendar. 16th year in the reign of King Zacharath VI. 10 days until midsummer. Through the rain, Indiriel stared at the blood-red tree. It was no more than a sapling, barely up to Indiriel's chest, but it writhed with vicious hunger. Crimson leaves stirred at the scent of his flesh, and red tendrils crept through the grass at his feet like rivulets of blood. It was trying to sneak up on him, to drag him in and drain his body dry. Indiriel flashed the hanging tree a smile, and stayed exactly where he was. The creeping roots stretched out to their full length, straining to reach him. They barely brushed the tips of his boots. The tree actually hissed, bending its trunk toward him like a dog straining against its leash. But it couldn't touch him. "Nice try," Indiriel said. He swept a bow, flourishing the end of his black Nye cloak. "Just checking up on you, master," he said. "Don't let me disturb your rest." A violet light flared in the corner of his vision, and he whipped around to face it. "Danger," whispered a voice in his head. It was a cold voice, dry and crumbling, like breath from a corpse 3 days old. The voice of his advisor, Kor. Indiriel shot a glance down, where a heavy gold medallion lay against his shirt. It was carved with the image of a skull, which held in its mouth a single dark amethyst. The gem pulsed with violet light. Deep in the forest, the same light, a light only Indiriel could see, burned like a flame without a candle. "Danger," Kor whispered again. Indiriel had never been sure whether Kor was the gold medallion or the jewel in its center. Or maybe Kor was a different being entirely, and he used the medallion as a mouthpiece. Indiriel had long given up trying to ask Kor himself. His advisor wasn't the chatty type, like Kai's dolls. He almost never said a word, preferring to make his warnings known through flashes of light. Kor only spoke in the face of danger. Whatever was happening off in the forest, Indiriel's advisor must think it important. And this time of year, in this place, only one threat mattered. Indiriel turned away from the tree, calling steel. Power flooded into him from Valenhal, wintry cold flowing through his body, reinforcing his muscles with the strength of iron. When the chill settled into his limbs, he hesitated, glancing at his forearm. Black imprints, like the shadows of chains tattooed into his flesh, began on the back of his hand and spiraled up his wrist. It was the same on his other arm. Even seconds after he called steel, the chains already reached his forearms. He shouldn't push his limits by calling too much power. The chains of Valenhal moved more slowly than they had when he was young, true, but they also took longer to retreat. If they wrapped around his neck... Indiriel almost laughed at himself. He was thinking like Kai, worrying instead of acting. The violet light still burned in the forest, and if there was danger there, he would meet it. If he called too much power, well, he would deal with that as it came. He hadn't made it this far by doubting himself. Indiriel stretched his mind back to his territory, reaching for a black box the Nye Eldest had given him long ago. He drew in a deep breath, filling his lungs with the moonlight essence of the Nye. With the steel in him, he felt as though his muscles were wrapped in bands of frigid metal, and the Nye essence raged like a blizzard in his chest. He was solid ice inside. The world slowed around him. The raindrops seemed to freeze, hanging in the air like sap sliding down the side of a tree. The leaves of the forest canopy, blowing in the storm winds, leaned to one side. Even the wind now pressed against his face like a solid wall of air, paused in mid-gust. Before he left, Indiriel shot a glance back at the crimson sapling. It waved its thorny branches helplessly in slow motion, still hungering for his blood. Good. For now, let it starve. It would get plenty of food over the next 10 days. Indiriel returned his attention to the pulsing violet star deep in the forest. He kicked off, launching himself into the trees. He shot into the forest like an arrow, blasting through the droplets hanging in the air. Good thing he had kept the hood of his cloak up, otherwise his face would be soaked. A huge trunk loomed in front of him, and he spun in midair, landing with his feet pressed against the rough bark. The spark still burned off to his left, and he adjusted course, kicking off from one tree to the next, his cloak fluttering in the air behind him. To someone on the ground, he must have looked like a shadow flickering from one tree to the next faster than the eye could follow, flowing deeper and deeper into the trees. He should know, the Nye in the house moved like this often enough. As he approached the violet light, it abruptly vanished, which meant he was close enough. Kor only dropped the light when Indiriel was so close he could see the danger for himself. Indiriel landed softly on the forest floor, releasing the Nye essence in a single blue-white breath. The essence wouldn't last much longer, and he wanted its full duration ready if he had to fight. Besides, it was easier to observe his targets through a world that moved at normal speed. The steel would last for a while yet, so he held it. Better to be safe. He crouched behind the branches of a redberry bush, surveying the scene. A donkey shifted and snorted nearby, hitched to a small cart filled with barrels and crates. A few paces away, a small woman hovered inches above the ground, twitching and jerking like a puppet under the effect of glowing asphodel mist. A gray-robed asphodel traveler stood over her, a mass of scars covering his face. They had to be from Enosh. Damascan travelers would never have entered the forest at this time of year without informing him first. Their king knew better. A blonde Naraka traveler stood beside the scarred asphodel mistbinder, her face twisted in disgust. Likely in pain as well, considering she had summoned a Morway, whose twisted wasp-like body was now curled up underneath a man's charred corpse. The agony from her summoning would have lingered. An asphodel and a Naraka. Not a usual combination, but not too rare. He shouldn't see much trouble from them. Indiriel could barely make out any features of the burned man, but the context of the scene completed the picture. A couple had set out from a nearby village to sell or deliver some goods, and had the misfortune to run across two Enosh travelers looking for the hanging tree. They were only a few dozen steps from the northwest edge of the Latari Forest, near the road leading up to Enosh. That explained why a pair of small-time village merchants had sheltered here against the rain. It was tragic, but there was nothing he could do for them now. Even if they weren't dead, they would be soon. He would follow the Enosh travelers, looking for a chance to ambush them whenever they let their guard down. He could probably beat them head-on, but there was no sense taking a chance to avenge some unfortunate villagers. He had to prevent the travelers from reaching the tree, no matter what. The Naraka woman lifted her palm toward the cart, her mark glowing cherry red. Why? Was there something in there she wanted destroyed? Maybe the merchant had found some artifact he should have left alone. The traveler spoke, and though Indiriel couldn't make out the sound of her voice over the rain, he read her lips. "I'm sorry," she said. Her mark flared. A sound came from the cart, like a dog's whimper. The walls of the cart shivered as though someone within was trying to crawl away. As the cart's walls dipped, Indiriel caught a glimpse of dark hair within the cart. A child. The villager couple had a child. The steel running through Indiriel's veins felt warm compared to the frost gripping his heart. He had seen children die before, too many, in his opinion. But every time he did, the same picture floated to the surface of his mind. His daughter, Elena, on the day of her birth. She was wrapped in a soft cloth, cradled in her mother's arms, smiling up at him for the first time. How could he let someone else's child suffer? He knew what Zachareth would tell him to do. "Wait for an opportunity," the king would say. "Bide your time. If the Enosh travelers reach the hanging tree, then more than this one child will die." But King Zachareth wasn't here, and Indiriel's daughter would be turning 9 this year. What kind of man would he be if he let this child die? He leaped over the bush and ran for the cart, cloak billowing behind him. He had hesitated too long. If only he had held on to the Nye essence, then he may have reacted fast enough. But now? Around the edge of the cart, Indiriel barely saw a cracked, burned, red and black hand seize the Naraka traveler's ankle. The boy's dying father heaved, screaming with his dying breath. Indiriel got a full glimpse of the Naraka traveler's shocked face before she fell over backwards, head slamming into the ground. The burned man collapsed again, his last breath gone. Indiriel slowed to a walk, his heart heavy. "I've never seen a man go more bravely than that," he said, almost to himself. But the boy in the cart heard. The kid squirmed to get a better look at Indiriel, twisting around in the back of the cart. Tears and terror were smeared across his face. The boy was as dark as Indiriel himself, obviously descended from one of the villages, and maybe 7 or 8 years old, skinny for his age. His eyes held all the horror that came from watching strangers murder his parents. Indiriel's heart ached. He had been almost 12 years old when he saw his parents cut apart by Damascan soldiers. How much worse would it be for a boy so much younger? He favored the boy with what he hoped was a comforting smile. "Are you hurt?" he asked. The Naraka traveler was scrambling to her feet, asking him some question, but he ignored her. Already rage pulsed along the steel in his veins. He would give her what she deserved shortly. For now, the boy was more important. The boy shook his head. "My mother and father are hurt," he said. "Please, don't hurt me." Indiriel's smile slipped. "Oh, Maker," he thought, "what a tragedy this is." The Asphodel man, whose face looked like someone had used it to sharpen knives, said something Indiriel didn't let himself hear. It would be some plea for diplomacy, no doubt, or an attempt to convince him that they were nothing more than ordinary wanderers lost in the woods who had come across an injured family. The Asphodel traveler was talking instead of attacking, so he hadn't recognized Indiriel. He didn't know what the Nye cloak meant, and he probably hadn't seen the chains on Indiriel's arms. He most likely planned on recognizing a Valenhal traveler by their sword. So be it. Indiriel would give this Enosh heretic an up-close and personal look at his dragon's fang. Indiriel reached out into the rain. The chains stretched past his elbow, wrapping his bicep. The Asphodel traveler's eyes widened, fear twisting his scars into a revolting mask. The Naraka still looked confused. Well, she would figure it out soon enough. He summoned Vasha. The sword shimmered briefly as it vanished from Valenhal and appeared in his hand. His fist closed around cloth. Vasha wasn't as long as some of the other fangs. Kai's Azura, for instance, or Valen's own Mithra, were almost uselessly long. Vasha was a more practical length, about 5 feet from the end of the pommel to the tip of its blade, and it did not gleam like the other Valenhal swords. Its surface was dull, pitted, its blade chipped. The steel was now all but indestructible, and nothing in his power could so much as scuff its polish, but obviously that had not always been the case. Indiriel liked it that way, rough, almost unfinished. It cut well enough. The Enosh travelers were shouting now. The blonde Naraka moved her hand in an intricate spiral of red light, eyes tightening in pain as she mentally called for whatever force she was trying to summon. Not another Morway, probably. She should know how futile that would be. He would cut the wasp out of the air. Possibly an ash hound, or one of the hulking Akhnadorma. Or maybe something even more exotic. Mist gathered around the gray-robed man's hands. The Enosh traveler had surely mastered his fear. Anything else would have been lethal for him, dealing with Asphodel. And it looked like he was cooking up a serious mist binding. "Well then," Indiriel thought, "best to cut that short." He called on his newly refilled Nye essence. Then he ran forward. Fueled by Benson's steel and accelerated by the power of the Nye, Indiriel covered the distance between himself and the two travelers in a blink. "Care," Kor whispered, and a violet spark appeared on the Naraka traveler's hand. The Naraka's blue eyes widened, and her summoning mark came up in a flash of red. Vivid orange flame swirled around her palm. She hadn't called a creature, but fire from the furnace of judgment. Good decision. The flames would come much faster, and they would surely pair well with whatever the asphodel came up with. As Indiriel understood it, fire from the furnace would bind its target and burn them according to their own guilt. The bright orange fireball appeared in front of the Naraka traveler's hands, formed of what seemed to be faces, wide-mouthed, screaming faces, that swirled among the flames like burning ghosts. They shrieked as they were summoned into the real world, blasting toward his chest. The fire would likely have caught Indiriel, despite his nigh-enhanced reflexes, if not for Kor's warning. Caught off guard, he would have been wrapped in flame, burning to his own crimes. Considering his past, he would be lucky to live through this one attack. He had enough sins for a dozen men. But if he did survive, the Asphodel Traveler was there to pour mist into him, feeding on the panic the furnace created. Between them, the mist and the flames would have eaten both his mind and his body from the inside out. Unprepared, he would have died an agonizing death. But Indiriel was prepared. At the first instant of Kor's warning, he pulled his blade back. As soon as the fire left the traveler's hands, he swept Vasha across his body, catching the fireball on the flat of his blade. There was a brief sense of faint resistance, as though he had slapped his sword against the surface of a lake, and then he swatted the flame aside. It blasted into the trees. The woman's eyes widened, in astonishment, he thought, not fear, and she looked straight at him. For a frozen instant, he stared into her pale blue eyes, saw the confusion in them. She didn't seem like a woman awaiting her own death. Indiriel's wife, Narissa, had eyes exactly the same shade of ice blue. This woman had Narissa's eyes. While his mind shouted protest, the training took over his body. Vasha flashed, slicing through bone with barely a tug. The hand with her summoning mark fell away. That was the safest way to deal with Naraka travelers. Dangerous hand first, then the other hand, then the killing blow. Sometimes, if you stabbed them through the heart from the beginning, they could still call up some horror with their last breath. Not missing both hands, though. The pain must have begun to register as she turned her confused eyes on her bleeding stump. Indiriel took her left hand before her right hit the ground. She looked up at him, still not understanding, her eyes so much like Narissa's that it hurt. Indiriel slid Vasha straight through her heart, holding his eyes on hers the whole time. He didn't want her to suffer. She was in this forest to sabotage the hanging tree, to release on the world a force without pity or weakness. But she had his wife's eyes. The least he could do was kill her quickly, before she had the time to feel any pain. Her body slid off his blade into the ground, and he allowed himself an instant to feel the weight of her death. How many had he killed? How many more would he kill before he was done? Who would wait for this woman to come home? Only an instant did he indulge his guilt. Then he brought his mind back to the business at hand. He wasn't the moping type. He preferred to think more encouraging thoughts about success rather than tragedy. But on nights like tonight, tragedy became hard to ignore. The Asphodel would be calling up his mist soon, so Indiriel did something he would have rather not done. He called Diamond. In his mind, he pictured a delicate diamond cut almost into a perfect sphere. The gem was the reward for conquering the Winter Garden, one of the deepest rooms in Valenhall. Indiriel called the diamond into him, let it take over his thoughts, his feelings, let it focus his memories and intentions into one blade-sharp arrow of intent. I hate this, Indiriel thought. Then the diamond took control. Everything became simple. The Asphodel man stood next to the body of his companion, his face composed underneath his scars. But of course he looked peaceful, because Asphodel travelers had to stay calm. Otherwise, their own territory would turn on them. Mist swirled around his hands, and Indiriel recognized the pattern. The binding was almost complete. He was about to summon the mists of Asphodel. Running forward would do no good. The mist would rise wherever Indiriel stood. So he stayed where he was. No need to complicate matters. The mists rose in half a dozen tendrils as thick around as Indiriel's thigh, crawling over his skin like cool, moist snakes. They moved with deceptive speed, reaching his face in less than a second. Mist slithered into him, through his nose, into his mouth, into his ears. He thought some particles might have even found their way in through his eyes. the illusions began. He saw Nerissa in front of him, crouching on the wet leaves of the Latari forest. She wept, eyes of blue ice locked on his face. "Please," she whispered, and held up an arm ending in a bloody stump. His sword dripped red. Indiriel's wife vanished, and his daughter took her place, 9 years old, running on her short legs from a pack of ash hounds. They trailed sparks through the air as they ran out of the trees, devouring the space between them and their prey. The dogs would pull her down in seconds. Without looking, Indiriel knew his feet were chained to the ground.
"Help me, Daddy!" she cried.
The images were a product of the mist. The more fear he felt, or anger, or pain, the worse they would become. Eventually his mind would shut down, unable to process reality any longer. They fed on emotion, the mists of Asphodel. So Indiriel chose to feel nothing. The diamond made his choice both clear and easy. If he felt emotion, he would go crazy, and the Enos travelers would find the hanging tree. So he felt nothing, as blazing hounds pulled his daughter to the forest floor. Indiriel stepped forward, and the mist was simply a cloud parting around him. He smiled broadly, showing off his teeth. Let the Asphodel traveler see how well his binding had worked. The traveler paled. He panicked, nearly tripping over his own feet in his haste to run away. Well, it was a good thing this traveler wasn't in Asphodel. That much terror would have devoured him in the real mists. The Nye essence was fading from Indiriel now, but that didn't matter much. Even the steel was waning, but he only needed a bit. It would only take the last dregs of his power to deal with this third-rate traveler. Still, Indiriel allowed the Asphodel a few seconds of a head start. It was only fair. "If I had been frightened, that much mist might have killed me," Indiriel called. "Maybe even driven me insane. I hear the mists of Asphodel have that effect on some people." It wasn't honorable of him to taunt a beaten opponent, he supposed, but who cared about honor outside of Tartarus? Besides, this was the only fun he was likely to get tonight. "But guess what?" Indiriel shouted. When he judged the traveler had run far enough, Indiriel leaped after him, his jump powered by steel. He landed inches behind the fleeing man, and then he put Vasha through the traveler's back. "I'm not afraid." He gave the Asphodel another smile the man couldn't see. He pushed the traveler off his sword. The big man toppled to the ground. Indiriel exhaled, letting his sword vanish and his steel run out. He kept the diamond, though, and his smile. He couldn't remember the last time he'd had this much fun. Indiriel walked back to the clearing with the cart and all the bodies. Someone would have to clean these up before Enosh found them. He would tell Zachareth to send some slaves out here tomorrow, maybe make a big bonfire. He stared into the Naraka traveler's empty blue eyes and imagined her body burning. A Naraka burning on her own pyre. Wouldn't that be fitting? The boy in the cart made a choking sound, and Indiriel remembered himself. "This isn't me," he realized. "I need to release the diamond." "Or do I?" "I do. But everything is clear. So easy." That was true. Why not hang on to it? The diamond lasted a long time, longer than most Valenhall powers, to be sure. And it made everything so simple. What was the harm? "Danger," Kor whispered. Indiriel glanced into the trees, looking for the spark of violet light indicating the presence of danger, but it wasn't there. He glanced down at the medallion. The light burned in his own chest. "Inside," Kor said. Indiriel sighed. "Fine," he thought. "You win." He released the diamond. Sensation flooded back in. Regret, pain, sympathy, guilt, duty. He almost turned to the boy in the cart, but a thought stopped him. "My mother and father are hurt," the boy had said. So Indiriel walked over to the boy's father. Burned and ravaged as the man's body was, Indiriel held out little hope for his survival. But he had seen men live through unlikely wounds before, so he pressed two fingers against the man's neck. Nothing. Indiriel sighed and shook his head, afraid to see the look on the boy's face. He walked over to the mother. With the death of the Asphodel traveler, she had been released from the grip of the mist. He took her pulse first. It was thready, weak, barely there at all. But her heart was beating. He peeled her eyelid back with two fingers. Her pupils dilated. She stared at something beyond his head. Her eyes flicked from side to side, as though tracking quick movement, and her breath came in gasping bursts. She would survive. Her physical injuries amounted to nothing more than a few bruises and pulled muscles, whatever she had incurred twisting herself about or falling over. But the mental damage would be far worse. He picked her up without much effort. He had no steel in him now, but he had kept his body in shape these last 20 years, and she was not a large woman. He brought her over to the boy's cart, tucking her in beside him, pulling the tarp over them both to keep out the rain. Indiriel winced as the boy snatched his mother back, pressing her to his chest as if to protect her from Indiriel.
"Are you the forest demon?" the boy whispered.
The forest demon? Was the old legend still around? If so, it probably applied to him. He had been the one to start that particular myth, after all. He smiled at the boy like he would smile at his own daughter. "Don't worry. I'm not going to hurt you." The boy sniffled and kept crying. Well, he had never claimed to be good with children.
"What's your name?" Indiriel asked.
"Simon, son of Kalmon."
"Very pleased to meet you," he said.
"And this is your mother?"
The boy nodded, pulling her closer to his chest. At least he had stopped crying. Indiriel hesitated. If the Valenhall healing pool would have done her any good, he would have opened a gate in a heartbeat and carried her there himself. But her wounds were more than physical, and the pool would be more danger than benefit. How was he supposed to explain that to an 8-year-old? He shook his head.
"I'm sorry. There's nothing I can do for her. If it was just the body..."
But Asphodel attacks the mind, the spirit. It will be years before she recovers, if ever. True words, but to his ears they sounded like excuses. The boy, Simon, started crying again. Not that Indiriel could blame him.
"I couldn't do anything," he said. "I just wanted to help, but I couldn't do it. I couldn't move."
He had to say something to comfort the kid. "It's not your fault, Simon. Not at all. But you can do something now, all right? I need you to take care of your mother for me. Can you do that?" The boy wiped snot from his nose with the back of his sleeve and nodded. "All right," Indiriel said calmly. He started to move around the cart toward the donkey, which, amazingly, hadn't panicked or bolted. "Now, where do you live?"
"Myria Village," Simon responded.
Indiriel repeated the name, thinking out loud. "That's a day or two northwest, I think. I can make it." Simon sat there, looking hopeful and sad and alone, so he said it more firmly. "I'll make it." It took Indiriel almost 20 minutes to get the donkey to pull them all the way out to the trader's road. In all that time, Simon didn't say a word. He didn't cry, either. He tended to his mother in silence. There had to be something Indiriel could do for him. He couldn't leave an 8-year-old boy to care for a mother who would probably never regain her sanity. Maybe he could take them in, raise them with his own family. Elena could use a little brother. No. Zachareth would never allow it. He was annoyed enough by the little of Indiriel's time he did not control. But there were still a few areas of Indiriel's life where the King of Damascus had no say. "Once you get a little older, you should come back to the forest if you can," Indiriel said. "I'll teach you how to make it so that travelers never bother you again." The forest was his post, and would be for the foreseeable future. Unless Zachareth made good on his threat to make Indiriel an overlord, he would be there to train Simon properly. Besides, it was about time the dragon army got a little new blood.
"They were travelers, then," Simon said.
He sounded lost, disappointed. "Yes," Indiriel said simply. "Some dreams of childhood needed to be crushed."
"Why did they hurt us?" Simon asked.
Tears filled his voice. "For a blood-red tree," Indiriel thought, but didn't say. "To open a prison and release the monsters inside." "Nothing you did, I promise you that," Indiriel said. "They were looking for something." That was all he would allow himself to say on the subject. "When we reach Myria, I'll do what I can for you. Help you take care of your mother as best I can. For a little while. But I can't leave my forest undefended for long. Not now." Not with midsummer so close. This failure would only make Enosh try even harder.
It's okay, Simon said. I can take care of her.
His voice was strong.
I know you can, Indiriel said. But if the Enosh travelers succeeded, if they destroyed the tree, no one would be safe. The villages near to Latari Forest, like Myria, they would suffer the worst. The incarnations would reap a harvest of blood and bone greater than the world had seen in centuries. Indiriel would put a stop to it, alone if he had to. He would show the Enosh Grandmasters what a soldier of the Dragon Army could do. Under the hood of his cloak, Indiriel smiled.
Chapter 2. Weapons Old and New. 358th year of the Damascan calendar, 24th year in the reign of King Zacharat VI, 30 days after midsummer, 15 days until summer's end. Kai missed his dolls. When a pack of six-legged obsidian wolves burst from the desert around him, sending fountains of sand exploding into the air, Kai was caught off guard. His dolls would have warned him. The wolves' bodies were made of smooth, polished black stone, their eyes of emerald. They each had three of those jeweled eyes, gleaming in the sun. They must be golems, guardians from Ornheim, left resting in the sand and waiting for someone to come by. They circled him now, prowling with a liquid grace that didn't seem possible for beings made of stone. There were four wolves in the pack, maybe five. One of his dolls would have known for sure. Angeline would have scolded him for not paying attention, but she would have told him how many and where they came from. Kayla would have warned him happily, proud of her own knowledge. Never again. They were with Simon now. The thought made him want to weep. A polished muzzle closed on his forearm, teeth like chips of stone beginning to grind into his flesh. Kai pictured a stone amulet, hidden in a chest back in Valenhall. He called stone. The wolf's teeth sunk into his skin but barely penetrated, as though his arm had gained the consistency of tough leather. Shadowy chains crawled up his arms, through the monster's jaws. It was an odd sensation, feeling the cold links of a chain flow up his skin while a monster chewed on it. The wolf jerked its jaws to one side, trying to tear his arm from its socket. Cold steel flowed through his veins, and his flesh was hard as stone. The creature would have to try harder. Kai tossed the black wolf aside. It landed 10 feet away, with enough force that its landing blasted sand away in a ring. The ground shuddered with impact. The other wolves froze in their prowling, turning emerald eyes on Kai. He looked past them, into the horizon of the Bedari Desert, where a huge sandstone temple awaited him. It was hewn of rough, enormous blocks of stone, and it crouched among the dunes as though it had weathered 1,000 summers, and would wait patiently for 1,000 more. Kai knew better. Ornheim travelers had summoned the stone for this temple from their territory less than 25 years before. He had watched it happen, though he had never planned to return. Well, since he was here, he might as well finish it. The wolves wouldn't wait around forever. Silently, Kai called out to the Valenhall Armory. He needed a weapon. A mirage shimmered in his hand for an instant before resolving itself into a hulking, double-edged battle axe. The steel head looked rough as stone, and the wooden shaft was dark and stained. End to end, it would stand almost 1 foot higher than the top of Kai's head. Oh, it was big enough, he supposed, but where was the beauty, the grace? Kai missed Azura. The obsidian wolves surged forward as one, trying to bring him down before he could use his weapon. Kai leaped forward to meet one, bringing his axe down on its skull with a satisfying crunch that crushed its head to shards like black glass. 6 legs landed on his back, almost bringing him to his knees under the weight. He spun around before the wolf could close its jaws on his neck, sending it flying off. He kept spinning, turning his momentum into a swing. The weapon slammed into another wolf's side, hammering it into the air and over a dune. He felt its body land on the other side. One of the wolves crept up behind him, aiming for his calf. He caught its movement out of the corner of his eyes, its motion strangely serpentine as it crawled forward on its 6 legs. Kai spun the axe like a quarterstaff. It wasn't weighted for such a move, but Kai's strength made up for it. and caught the wolf under the ribs with the axe's shaft. He swept the creature into the air, then reversed his swing, cleaving the wolf in two. Chips of obsidian sprayed into the air, prickling Kai's skin. If he hadn't called stone, they would have left ribbons of blood behind. Another jaw closed on his elbow and pulled him backwards, unbalancing him and sending him sprawling on his back into the sand. Kai felt an instant of instinctive fear, lying on his back and looking up into the gleaming black jaws of two stone wolves. Their triple emerald eyes fixed on him, and he would have sworn they gleamed.
No need to be afraid, Kai reminded himself. They can chew all they like and never get a drop of blood.
They couldn't penetrate his flesh. All he needed to do was let them gnaw on him for a moment and wait for his time to strike back, as long as his stone power lasted long enough. At that exact moment, his stone ran out. He should have known. Stone recovered quickly, but it ran out just as fast. It was intended to block an attack or two, not last through an entire battle, but he still thought he would have had a few more seconds. There he was, on his back, about to be eaten by a couple of Ornheim wolves. Oh, how Otoku would have mocked him. Kai drew seal deeply, feeling it flood his veins in an icy torrent that dwarfed what he had held before. With one hand, he seized a wolf's snout before its jaws closed on his throat. The other hand, he slid up the shaft of his axe, grasping the weapon below the head. As the second wolf dove toward its belly, Kai hammered the axe head into its body. He could barely get any leverage, so he battered at it again and again. The wolf in his grip strained, trying to reach his throat. It was eerily quiet. A natural wolf would have snarled or growled, but the obsidian creature pushed forward like a silent, pitiless machine, its emerald eyes flaring with reflected sunlight. The second wolf finally died under the brutal hammering, collapsing onto Kai's stomach in a heap of lifeless rock. Kai was free to turn the axe on the wolf he held in his hand. It did not last long. When both wolves were dead, Kai hauled himself to his feet. Shards of obsidian clinked and rattled as they slid from his chest. He almost released the steel. He had seconds left at best, and the power would take most of an hour to regenerate under these conditions. But some instinct made him hold on. He stood still, holding the battle axe in both hands. He listened. Something scraped behind him, little more than a pebble sliding down a dune. In one movement, Kai turned, reversing his axe as he did, and plunged his heavy weapon straight down on the wolf that had tried to sneak up on him. The creature was crushed under the blow, shattering instantly. Its emerald eyes were inches from Kai's calf. Kai smiled. He hadn't even needed a warning. If Kayla could see him now, she would be so proud. Walking toward the temple, he let the axe drop to the sand. It was scratched and chipped from his battle with the wolves, and he thought the end of the shaft might have even splintered. The weapon would fade back to Valenhall eventually, where one of the Nai would take it into the forge and do what they could to repair it. They might strip it down and use it for raw materials. It was no dragon's fang, after all. And that touched the heart of why Kai was headed to this temple in the first place. It had taken him weeks to reach this far into the Bidari Desert on foot, and now he was finally this close to his goal. By sunset, he would have a real weapon again. Then he could go home. Simon held Azura in both hands, staring out into a room filled with thick, leafy jungle plants and pelting rain. A piping scream cut through the roar of the rain, sounding like the cry of some exotic bird. Knowing Valenhall, it was probably something far more deadly than any bird. He raised his huge sword and eyed the door on the other side of the room. A cobblestone path cut through the grass carpeting the rest of the area, and it led directly to a stone door with a running wolf carved into its face. Simon was so far away now, he could barely see the outline of the wolf carving, but he had tried to reach the door so often that he burned with curiosity. He had to see what was behind the door. "Go now," Lilia whispered in his mind. Like all his dolls, she sounded as though she was speaking through a gentle wind, although she actually sat on the stone floor by his feet. She wore a frilly dress of pure white and had huge, innocent purple eyes. He had tucked her safely under the overhang, away from the rain. Kai would murder him if he ruined her dress. At the doll's signal, Simon stepped into the downpour as a clear spot opened in the weather. He stood surrounded by rain,
but remained totally dry. The clear spot in the rain moved forward, and he stepped with it, raising his sword above him as though to chop. He stepped again and brought the sword down. Another step, and he crouched on the balls of his feet, the sword arched behind him and to one side. With each step he took, he assumed one of the sword forms Chaka had taught him. If he executed each of the positions correctly, he would reach the other side of the room completely dry. This was his 14th attempt to conquer what he and the other residents of Valenhall had dubbed the Rain Garden. He had never made it more than halfway. But he liked his chances this time. The rain pounded around him, assaulting his ears, and the clear spot began to move more quickly. He stepped forward from form to form, faster and faster, slashing and blocking and dodging invisible opponents until he moved almost as fast as he would in an actual battle. He had passed the first landmark of the Rain Garden, a cluster of tall purple flowers with blossoms like trumpets, growing to one side of the path. That meant he was almost two-thirds of the way there. He had never made it so far before, and had never run through the routine so quickly. He started to lose track of the forms. He stepped forward, and couldn't remember if he was supposed to lunge forward or pivot for a slash. He needed more time, so he reached out in his mind to a black box the Nye Eldest had once given him. Chaka had warned him that he would learn nothing from this test if he simply relied on his powers to pass. But how would he know? Simon certainly wasn't going to tell him. A rush of cold moonlight filled his lungs as he drew on the essence of the Nye. The world slowed. Instead of hurtling to the earth, the raindrops seemed to crawl. At that speed, Simon could see the outline left by the absence of rain, and he fitted himself into it. He had to remember to move slowly and carefully, though, since in this test too fast was as bad as too slow. But he had no chance of failing now. No wonder Chaka hadn't wanted him to call the essence. It made the test too easy. Simon made it through three more forms before he realized the rain was speeding up. At first, he wasn't worried. He could move faster, too. He increased the speed of his forms, cutting and spinning and piercing invisible enemies by the dozen. The rain sped up again. Without the essence in him, it would have been impossible to follow. Soon, Simon was moving as frantically as before, moving from form to form so quickly that he knew an onlooker would see him as nothing more than a silver flashing blur. But somehow the rain moved faster still. Even the droplets didn't seem as slow as before, rushing down almost as quickly as they had when he first entered the room. Was the essence running out? No, it still rushed through his lungs like the breath of winter itself. So what was going on?
Oh, right, I may have forgot to mention, Lilia said absently. The rain speeds up to match you, so you probably shouldn't use your Nye essence.
Too late now, Simon sent back, a little bitterly. The door was so close. Surely he could make it this time.
I thought I told you, Lilia said. Or did I? No, I certainly forgot.
The weather did something Simon had never seen before. It froze. The clearing above stopped moving forward, but Simon thoughtlessly stepped into his next form, sweeping his sword out in a slashing blow that cut through the rain. Water pelted down, soaking him in seconds. His doll gasped.
Oh, dear. You should run.
He would have, but the raindrops were coming so fast that they slammed into his skin like hundreds of tiny hammers. Desperate, he called Steel, the icy strength rushing through his blood. Then he turned away from the wolf-carved door and began to run back toward Lilia, who sat next to the far entrance. Maybe, with Steel and essence in him, he could make it. The rain stopped.
Behind you, Lilia murmured.
She didn't sound as upset as she should have. Simon spun around, swinging Azura through the creature he knew he would see behind him. Something like a long-necked cat, only shaped entirely of water. It hissed when Simon's sword cut through its neck, revealing a mouthful of icicle teeth. Simon's strike did about as much good as if he had attacked a waterfall, passing through without dealing any real damage. But the cat stopped for a split second to let its neck reform. Simon took advantage of that instant to turn back around and keep running. He couldn't afford to slow down. There were hundreds of those cats following him with the inevitability of a rushing river, the leader snapping at his heels. Even with his enhanced speed, Simon couldn't outrun them. In fact, a pair of the cats jumped onto his shoulders, sinking ice-cold teeth into his collar. He screamed but didn't stop running.
"Hey, they're still behind you," Lilia said.
Simon didn't open the door so much as he crashed into it, barely remembering at the last second to spin around and scoop up Lilia and his black cloak, which he had left behind so it didn't slow him down. So much for that. Wind from the courtyard whipped him as he stepped through the door, but he ignored it as he slammed the heavy stone door shut. There came a sound like the rushing of an ocean wave as all the rain cats slammed against the door in a torrent. Water oozed through the crack at the bottom of the door, puddling next to his feet.
"I had a dream like this once," the doll said.
The two cats that had shredded Simon's shoulders let out a yowl as they melted, covering him in icy rainwater. It looked like they could only exist in the rain garden, which was a relief. He had been afraid he would have to fight them from room to room throughout the whole house.
"Almost made it," Simon panted.
His shoulders burned, and he was starting to feel a little lightheaded.
"Did you?" Lilia said. "I didn't notice."
Simon grabbed an imp around the middle, which felt like grabbing a rough leather bag full of sticks, and tossed it out of the pool. It landed on four clawed feet and hissed angrily at him, raising a ridge of spines on top of its knobbed head. He followed the imp out of the water ahead of a dozen more of its kind. The surface of the pool churned with activity under the surface, but he had made it out in time. In the past, he had stayed in longer and survived, but this time the fight wasn't worth it. The longer he stayed in the water, the more imps he would attract. Simon aimed a kick at the imp on dry land, but it dodged him and jumped back into the pool. The last he saw of it was its red eyes as it glared at him, swimming backwards into the murky depths. He rolled his shoulders, healthy skin and muscle replacing what had been bleeding gashes only minutes before. There was a time, not long ago, when staying in the bath long enough to heal serious wounds had meant risking his life. Now, he could shake off the imps without even calling steel or carrying a weapon. Sure, he was getting better, but not fast enough. Not when he still couldn't make it across the rain garden. Almost involuntarily, Simon raised one hand to his bare chest. Three long scars slashed diagonally down his body, leaving uneven ridges. It looked as though a monster had tried to carve him open with its huge claws. Which was, in fact, exactly what had happened. It had been 8 weeks since his battle out in the wilderness, where he had fought over a dozen Damascan travelers and come out alive. Broken, bleeding, and barely conscious, but alive. Well, from his perspective, 2 months had passed, but he had spent the vast majority of his time since then training and recovering in Valenhall. He supposed that, in the outside world, it had only been about a month. He had come far too close to death in that battle. Even the pool had been unable to mend his injuries completely, leaving him with an impressive collection of scars. The three slashes across his chest were the worst, but Olyssa had said he should have spent the rest of his life in a crippled wreck of a body. Simon believed her. Even with the pool's healing, he had spent most of 4 weeks bruised, sore, and aching. Only recently had he been able to swing a sword without his muscles tightening, but as soon as he could, he had begun his training anew. He never wanted to find himself so close to death again. Kai would have done better, Simon thought.
Kai had inappropriate dreams about his dolls, Lilia pointed out. I would not suggest him as a role model.
She did not sound as sarcastic as Otoku would have. She always sounded thoughtful and distant, as though she were half lost in a daydream. At the moment, she sat across the room next to his clothes, facing the wall. He always pointed the dolls away from him while he bathed. They were girls, and it wasn't proper. Well, they were wooden toys, but he felt better with them looking away. Simon began to dry himself off with a towel that one of the Nai had left folded on the floor nearby. "He's strong," he sent. "One day I hope to be as strong as he is."
"Why?" Lilia asked. She sounded honestly curious.
Simon couldn't think of a good answer, but he tried. "Because I'm a Valenhall traveler now, so I might as well be a good one."
"Do you have to be strong to be good?"
Lilia, Simon was beginning to notice, asked a lot of questions. Three raps echoed through the room as someone hammered on the door. The bathroom had no locks, which once hadn't been a problem, but now Vallenhall housed two women. There had been some incidents early on that Andra and Olyssa found hilarious, but that made Simon distinctly uncomfortable. Now everyone had learned to knock. "One moment," Simon called, but the door began to open anyway. He hurriedly wrapped the towel around his waist. Orestes poked his head inside. His face was hard, as usual, with his iron-gray hair and eyes that looked carved from steel. "Olyssa wants you," he said. "She's got something she wants to show you." He eyed Simon up and down. "You should probably wear pants," he suggested. The door slammed shut. Simon joined him outside about a minute later, fully clothed and cradling Lilia in one arm. He left Azura sitting on the edge of the tub. One of the Nai would return the sword to its rack in the entry hall, probably before he could have walked there himself. He left the cloak, too, though the eldest wouldn't be happy about that. Simon couldn't stand wearing the thing around the house. They walked down the hallway in silence, Orestes marching along like the military man he was. Simon had never connected with the older man, possibly because Simon had killed most of the soldiers under his command, defeated Orestes himself in one-on-one combat, and tossed him into an unknown territory with no way to return. The atmosphere between them remained awkward. "So, how are you settling in?" Simon said. It was the first thing he had thought of to say that sounded better than, "You don't want to kill me, do you?" Orestes glanced down at Simon with a look that could have frozen a bonfire. Then again, Orestes always looked like that. "Well enough, all things considered. The healing pool of yours makes me feel 20 years younger, and thanks to Chaka, I'm a better swordsman than I've ever been." "That's good," Simon said. "I was worried you'd be, uncomfortable here, considering." He winced. Far too direct. Orestes remained silent until they reached the door to the garden, a polished wooden door carved with a flowering tree. There were several gardens in Vallenhall, Simon had learned, but as this one was relatively close to the front of the house, it was used most often as a meeting place. Besides, it was the best source of food and water in Vallenhall. Orestes paused with his hand on the door. "That was going to be my last assignment. Did you know that?" Orestes said. "I've spent my life in the army. Once I took care of one little peacekeeping problem in the north, I had Malachi's permission to retire. I have no wife, no children, so I was going to move in with the Agnos family. Caius and Olyssa have always been friends to me." Simon didn't say anything. Orestes had never said anything like this, and he was afraid to break the spell. He didn't move. He was almost afraid to breathe. Orestes nodded toward the door. Caius was a merchant. He sold general supplies to the villages in Malachi and Deborah's realms. His family has been on the move all their lives, but Malachi had finally given them the deed to a little plot of land on the border. We were all going to settle down in a village. The children would have grown up with friends their own age. Then you came along. Orestes didn't look in Simon's direction, and his voice didn't change, but his grip on the door handle tightened. You had left us in Vallenhall for 2 days before someone came along to let us back into the real world. Dinner, the man with the giant book, he let us out. But we quickly discovered the Overlord was dead. With him gone, no one would honor our deed. No one in the village had heard of us. Even our supplies were gone, stolen by the prisoners you freed. We came back here because we have nowhere else to go. Orestes looked at Simon with eyes of steel. I don't hold a grudge, he said. You were doing your job, like I was doing mine when I arrested your villagers. But you stole my life, and you killed my men. We are not friends. He pushed the garden door open and walked inside. Simon stood at the entrance of the garden for a moment, a little sick. He'd only meant to free his friends from Myria, but in doing so, how many lives had he ruined? Did they hate him? Maybe they should. He wasn't sure what he would have done differently, though. I don't think he likes you very much, Lilia observed. The garden didn't look like a room at all,
but like a meadow the size of Simon's entire village. Wind ruffled the tips of the grass, and the sun shone directly overhead in a cloudless sky. An odd creature, like a hairless ox with three horns, grazed nearby, while the rest of its herd galloped on the horizon. A spring-fed stream cut the field in half, crossing in front of the room's most obvious feature, a huge fruit tree at the center of the garden. Even from this distance, spots of color showed through the leaves, where exotic fruits hung from the tree's limbs. Simon had tasted 6 or 7 different fruits from that tree, and he had never sampled the highest branches. Usually, Chaka rested in the shade beneath the fruit tree, waiting for challengers to duel him for meals. Today, he leaped around the meadow, his sword arms flashing in the sunlight. He faced 2 opponents, Andra and Lycus, the 2 children of the Agnos family. Lycus had celebrated his 11th birthday in the house, while his sister Andra stood a head taller at 13. They both had the naturally tanned skin Simon associated with villagers, but the blonde hair shared by many Damascans. Lycus stabbed at Chaka's midsection, a look of intense focus on his face. He was using a straight short sword, little more than a long knife, not one of the gracefully curving dragon's fangs forged by the Wanderer. His older sister had a much better weapon, Seijan, the 10th fang, the shining steel of its blade marred by black spots like ink blots. Andra saw Lycus' attack and matched his timing, striking at Chaka's neck from the opposite side. She swung her blade as if dancing, laughing as she did. Get him, Simon thought, mentally urging them on. Just once he wanted to see Chaka actually lose a fight.
They won't, Lilia responded dreamily. Chaka doesn't lose unless he wants to.
Chaka had no hands, only sword blades where hands should be. He parried Lycus's blade with his left arm, knocking it wide, blocking Andra's attack with his right. The edge of Lycus's sword barely scarred the leather of Chaka's chest. When Simon had first seen Chaka, he had assumed the fighter was nothing more than a man in mismatched leather. Not an inch of his skin showed underneath bits of leather armor held in place by crisscrossed belts, straps, and buckles. Even his eyes were hidden by a helmet of hardened leather, and a leather mask covered his mouth. Simon had learned much since then. Chaka was not a man. At least, not anymore. Chaka's mask split, and his leather lips stretched into a smile.
"That's not bad there. You nicked me good. I'll have to get the knife to polish me up. Nice job, both of you. Now let's get a bite, eh?"
Orastes, who had taken up a stance nearby where he could watch the battle, applauded. "You're working together well," he said. "Stay in the habit. You're never alone on the battlefield." "Yes, sir," Andra and Lycus chorused. Orastes nodded at them and stepped forward, drawing his own sword. It was a standard Damascan infantry sword, short and straight, but it shone like a mirror, like one of the dragon's fangs. Simon had learned firsthand that the blade was a match for Azura, unlike a sword of ordinary steel. The Agnos children still hadn't spotted Simon, and he wanted to put that off as long as possible. Something about Orastes' earlier story was making him uncomfortable. But he still edged forward a few steps to get a better view of the upcoming duel. Orastes may not have the strength and speed of a Valenhall traveler, but he had lived as a soldier for most of his life. A match between him and Chaka was well worth a watch. Chaka waved one bladed arm in dismissal.
"Nah, don't even worry about it. You're good enough to be getting on with. Come on over here and grab some lunch. I already know you deserve it."
Even his yellow gemstone eyes somehow looked warmer. Simon realized his mouth was hanging open and closed it. He couldn't remember if he'd ever seen Chaka smile before. He raised Lilia up to eye level.
"What was that about?" he asked. "Chaka would never have let Lycus cut him. And he's never that nice, either."
Lilia's painted lips curled up in a smile, and Simon almost dropped her in the grass. The paint had moved right in front of him. The dolls were alive!
"I told you, Chaka doesn't lose," Lilia said. "Not unless he wants to."
"Did you smile at me?" Simon said. Lilia said nothing, but he could sense her sleepy amusement.
"No, be honest with me," he said. Did you just..."
He was cut off when Andra finally noticed his presence.
"Simon!" she shouted, and scrambled over to him, grinning.
Lycus followed, but slowly and without the smile.
"Did you see us?" Andra asked excitedly. "We got Chaka!"
Simon glanced behind her at Chaka, sitting underneath the fruit tree. He was staring straight back at Simon, his jeweled eyes burning.
"Yeah, I saw," Simon said. "You did great."
Andra's eyes sparkled, and she leaned in close.
"Chaka says it took you ages to get a cut on him."
Ages? He had earned his supper from Chaka on the second day. And getting the first cut had only taken a few weeks. Andra and Lycus had been in Valenhall at least that long, with the way time worked here. Then again, he had used the Nye essence the first time he landed a real blow on Chaka.
"Don't listen to everything Chaka tells you," Simon said, glaring at the leather man.
Behind Andra, Chaka raised one bladed arm and scraped it across the other as if sharpening knives. Simon didn't know what the gesture meant, but he was sure it wasn't friendly.
Lycus stared up at Simon.
"How was the rain garden?" he asked.
Once, he would have looked at Simon like a hero from the stories. Now his stare was all but empty. Simon shook his head, but tried to change the subject.
"Where's your mother? Erastes said she wanted to see me."
Erastes, sitting next to Chaka and munching on a red piece of fruit, said nothing.
Andra's eyes brightened.
"Oh yeah, you haven't seen it yet. Come on, follow me. It's brilliant."
As Simon carried Lilia after Andra, he sighed inwardly. Andra had a tendency to get excited over small things, like a trio of Nye children hiding among the clothes of the laundry basket. Chances were slim that she would show him anything worth his time. Andra led him into the forge, a long room with walls of black stone. Nooks set into the walls every few paces held anvils, bellows, ovens, racks of tools, barrels of iron stock, buckets of water, boxes of coal, and every other piece of smithing equipment Simon would expect. Lycus and Andra's father, Caius, stood behind an iron anvil, a smock on his belly and a heavy blacksmith's hammer in one hand. He looked as though he belonged there, pounding furiously away at a hot plate of metal. Flying sparks sent waves of light through the room. Under ordinary circumstances, Simon had thought of Caius as warm and friendly, but soft, the kind of man who delivered goods because he couldn't be bothered to do a day of real work. Simon's own father had been a merchant, so he knew not all merchants were fat and lazy, but Caius seemed to fit Simon's image of a well-to-do Damascan trader. In the red-hot light of the sparks, Caius had transformed into an entirely different man. He glanced up when Simon and his children entered the room, and a broad smile split his face.
"Just a minute," he called. "I'm almost done here."
Lycus and Andra had evidently expected this answer, because they nodded and made themselves at home in the forge. Lycus hopped up on a crate and watched his father work, while Andra grabbed a pair of pliers and used them to poke around. Simon stood where he was, watching Caius and trying to figure out what he was making. It looked like a shallow bowl or a plate, but he had stretched it into an oval shape. Maybe it was supposed to be a part of something, like a piece of armor or plating on a shield. As Caius turned the whatever it was to hammer it from a different angle, he revealed that one half of the plate was darker than the other. It seemed he had joined two different metals together. Why? He decided Caius was repairing something from the armory.
"The Nye usually do that sort of work," Lilia pointed out. "Why is Caius taking over for them?"
That was a good point. Maybe Caius simply liked working with his hands, so the Nye were letting him do a few repairs around the house.